We very warmly welcome each and every one of you here tonight. We were wondering with the inclement weather if we might have a fewer people, but we're glad that you at least made it, okay? So a very warm welcome. My name is Royal Hamill, and I will be your moderator for this evening. And so one of the most important parts of my job is to tell you where the bathrooms are, always. Just leaving the sanctuary, turn to the left, and then immediately turn to the right. So that will get you safely there. When I invited a friend of mine to be here tonight, he indicated to me that he was interested in coming, but he also indicated that he was not interested in coming if this was going to be an occasion for simply bashing transgendered people. And so I simply told him, no, that's not what we are about. We are Christians. Our fundamental starting point is that we love people, all people. Now, that doesn't mean we accept all actions as being equal or right. We do not put our stamp of approval on everything that passes in society. We couldn't possibly do that. But fundamentally, we care about society. We care about individual people. So why should Christians be concerned with the transgender movement in Canada and around the world? I have 8 reasons why, but they're all short, okay? Because I'm not speaking tonight. This is merely the introduction. First of all, it is an issue that concerns truth and reality, and Christians are vitally concerned with both. It is an issue that affects vulnerable children. The weakest members of our society are already being affected and will be affected even more. It is an issue that affects not just the transgender person, but it affects parents, wives, husbands, grandparents, uncles, aunts, cousins. In short, the entire extended family is affected by these issues. It is an issue that affects the historical right to free speech, the right of individuals to offer an alternative explanation for this phenomenon is now under threat in Canada. It is an issue that affects the rights of experts such as therapists, counselors, medical doctors to offer their best professional advice and counsel. It is an issue that affects high school teachers and public school teachers as they day by day relate to young charges under their care and counsel. It is an issue that affects women all around the world increasingly. And the trend is bound to increase as trans women are becoming the winners of the medals in women's sport all over the place. Finally, transgender people are beginning to come into our churches. And we who call ourselves Christians need to know how God would desire us to respond. Now, it is very unlikely that all the issues I have referenced can be or will be touched on tonight, unless you're willing to make it a 2-week evening. But it is time for somebody to make a beginning, and so tonight we are making a beginning. 2 speakers will present tonight, Pastor David Williams and Robert Wenman. And then there will be a brief 5-minute stretch while we set up the microphone and some chairs up here, and there will be a time for a question and answers. And so we will begin with Pastor David Williams, who holds 2 advanced degrees in mathematics as well as a Master's of Divinity. He has been in professional ministry for 15 years. Reverend Williams also has many years of experience volunteering with youth and young adults. He serves on multiple committees for his denomination, engaging pastoral candidates seeking accreditation, as well as teaching courses for the leadership and pastoral training programs aimed at developing theologically grounded lay people and lay pastors in Ontario and Quebec. Wow, I'm exhausted after that sentence. He is an active member of the Evangelical Fellowship of Guelph and the treasurer for the parent council at his daughter's school. He engages with a wide range of groups confronted with questions on contemporary issues. Applying his analytical mindset to scripture and theology, his goal is to help people think carefully through difficult issues and apply the truth of scripture to new questions that they face, and to enrich their relationships with God and with their community at the same time. So let us welcome Pastor David Williams.
Thank you very much. After that introduction, I was wondering if somebody else was going to get up. And thankfully, I do not have to cover all eight of Royal's reasons why this is an important topic for us to discuss. I want to welcome you all here. I am the pastor here at this church, so I feel a sense of ownership over this event. And so I do want to welcome you and admit it is with fear and trepidation that I stand before you to talk about this subject. Because if over the past 5 or 6 years you have engaged in looking at any of the conversation around this topic, you will have seen that it is a topic that very quickly becomes toxic. The name-calling, the vilifying from all directions makes it a topic that one might choose not to touch with a 10-foot pole, and here I am. I would be anxious if this was just my church congregation that I was speaking to, but I know with my church congregation, I have built up, hopefully, enough relationship capital with them that if I was to say something with which somebody in my church congregation disagreed, we could talk about it more. They would not immediately cut off the relationship. They know me well enough to know that they can talk about it, and in theory, we can even agree to disagree and continue to fellowship together. But as I look around the room, I see some familiar faces, but I realize most of you, I don't know at all, and you don't know me. And we do not have the relationship capital that if I say something that you don't like, that you will feel like maybe, you know, you can talk with me afterwards. And so some of you here listening tonight, also we're recording this. It'll be posted online on our church website. So maybe you're listening online or watching online, or maybe you've read the transcript I sent out. Somebody, at least one person engaging in this material, I'm sure, struggles with gender identity questions. Or somebody here or listening online knows somebody who struggles with gender identity questions. And so my primary concern this evening, if nothing else, when you go home, I want you to realize my primary concern is the well-being of others. My primary concern is your well-being. My primary concern is the well-being of the people you know and the people who may be listening or engaging with this at another time. Especially, my deepest concern this evening is for the well-being of people who struggle with gender identity questions. If nothing else, at the end of the evening, whether you disagree with everything I say, I want you to be able to go home, reflect on what I said and how I said it, and at least be able to say, I may disagree with everything that Pastor Dave Guy said, but I do know he is concerned with my well-being and the well-being of people who struggle with gender identity questions. If nothing else, that needs to be firmly established by the time I'm done this evening. I don't actually want to be up here. Saying anything on this topic that doesn't rehearse the current politically correct narrative opens a person up to criticisms, to charge of bigotry, to phobia, all sorts of things. But because I am deeply concerned with those being affected by that narrative, whether people who struggle with gender identity questions, their friends, their family, their loved ones, whether it's teachers at schools, politicians, doctors, because of my deep concern for people directly or indirectly affected by these questions, I'm here. And I want to offer ways that we can respond in loving compassion to the people affected by this really quite serious issue. So that's why I'm here. Now, one of the reasons why this topic is so charged for people is that unlike philosophical or theological, political or economic theories, this issue directly affects people who are hurting. Now, certainly, philosophy, theology, economics, and politics affect people, but I don't know anybody who holds their political views so closely that they choose that is their identity. I don't know anybody who holds their economic views so closely that they say, this is my identity. Whether you agree with me or not, whether you are a Christian or not, it is vital that each and every one of us make a conscious decision when it comes to discussing this topic with people who agree with us or not, that we always do it with a deep compassion for those affected by gender identity questions. We need to demonstrate a deep-seated care and concern for those experiencing inevitable distress that comes when one's inner sense of gender is out of sync with their biological sex. Regardless of the solution to gender dysphoria, it is a painful experience. We have to recognize it's emotionally painful. Euphoria, most of us know the word about euphoric or euphoria. Euphoria is a sustained or intense sense of happiness and excitement. The opposite of euphoria is dysphoria, a sustained or intense sense of unease or dissatisfaction. Gender dysphoria, then, is an appropriate term because if there was no intense unease or dissatisfaction, then we would not be suggesting to people that they undergo radical surgical procedures to solve the problem. I know some people say, it's not dysphoria, it's my identity. But if there was no dysphoria, surgery wouldn't be one of the options. I'm losing my hair. I have hair follicle dysphoria. I don't like going bald. But it's not that big a deal that I'm saying the government should pay for me to have surgery so that I'm a fully haired person, right? To suggest to someone that they endure such surgical procedures must be the result of extreme symptoms. And so I am going to use the term gender dysphoria throughout my discussion this evening, even if some people may say that's not politically correct or that's not their experience. If you are experiencing gender identity disconnects and you're not experiencing dysphoria, great. For most people who experience that disconnect, it is an unpleasant experience. And so please allow them the room to call it dysphoria. Now, I don't want to argue about whether or not gender dysphoria is a real thing. People experience it. The issue is not whether or not gender dysphoria exists. The issue is what is the best or appropriate treatment for somebody who's experiencing it. If you experience gender dysphoria, let me say, I want to express sorrow for your experience and all that comes with it. I truly hope if you are experiencing gender dysphoria that you find harmony between your body and your inner sense of self. I can only imagine the difficulty of living life when those two things are out of sync. And I want to have compassion for you because that is a painful experience regardless of what the solution may be. How we should respond as individuals and as a society, that is a difficult question. But let me tell you, telling somebody who experiences gender dysphoria, oh, your gender is just your biological sex, is no more helpful than telling a depressed person, life is good, cheer up. Or a person who struggles with anxiety, don't worry, be happy. They are such empty platitudes, it is not helpful, and it's actually dismissive and disrespectful to the person's experience. Now, I want to engage in a thought experiment for a moment to give some context to what we're talking about. I want you to imagine a young girl. Here we have a picture of Scout Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird. Because apparently when you Google search tomboy, there's a brand of clothing. Who knew? Their pictures were all over. So imagine a young girl who's talking to her doctor. And she's maybe 10 or 11 years old. And she's telling her doctor, I always like playing with boys more than girls. I like to climb trees and play with trucks. I would rather have short hair, wear jeans, and make mud pies than wear dresses and play with dolls. And then she declares to her doctor, I think I'm a boy trapped in a girl's body. She then asks her doctor for puberty blockers and hormone injections and inquires when she can start transition surgery. Now, on the other hand, consider a similar young girl, maybe even a few years older, 13, 14 years old. She's talking to her doctor, and she says, I've always liked playing with boys more than girls. I like to climb trees and play with trucks. I would rather have short hair, wear jeans, and make mud pies than wear dresses and play with dolls. Then she declares, I know inside I'm a girl, but my body doesn't look like it. I want you to give me estrogen injections and breast implants so that my body matches my inner sense of femininity. Now, she says, I want to be curvy and busty like the women I see on the internet. Why is it that the first girl we tell, great, embrace your inner sense of identity, we'll give you those puberty blocking injections and we'll sign you up to have radical surgery? But the second girl, we would say, no, 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 wait until you're through puberty. No, no, no. Your understanding of femininity is wrong. You don't have to have curves and large breasts to be a woman. We tell the second girl, you're just a tomboy. You can express femininity in different ways. But the first girl, we say, oh yes, you must be a boy trapped in a girl's body. The first girl, doctors are championing, and if a doctor denies that first girl the treatment that she requests, that doctor can be drummed out of business, they can lose licensing, they can be kicked off boards, and they're called bigots and haters and all of this. It's a very similar situation. Two people asking for the same procedures. One is championed, the other is told, no, that's not right. Why do we tell a person who feels like their sex doesn't match their gender, why don't we tell them to wait until after they finish puberty to make such a determination? Why don't we challenge that person's preconceptions about what it means to be male and female? Why can't a little boy like pink and lace? Why can't a girl be what used to be called a tomboy? Why is that a problem? And we say your gender is wrong or your body is wrong. Intuitively, we know it's not good to give a 14-year-old girl breast implants to bring her body into harmony with her identity. But why do we give a 10-year-old girl puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones to bring her body into harmony with her sense of gender identity? To get to why we have this disconnect between these two scenarios, we actually need to take a step back and look at a much bigger picture of which gender identity is merely one application. So forgive me, we're going to go on a bit of a ride here. How did we get here as a society? We're going to look at the big picture, and then the application is about gender identity, because ideas matter. Some of you may be familiar with the term postmodernism. It's a movement in philosophy that it's not important you understand all of it, but the way for tonight's discussion, the way that it boils down, it's actually nuanced and robust, but the way it's boiled down to the street level thinking is what's true for you is true for you. What's true for me is true for me. Truth is relative. We've all come to be the arbiters, our own arbiters, of truth and morality, of what is true, what is right, and what is wrong. We each get to choose in our society because of the philosophical movement called postmodernism. What this means then is there's no out there, there's no objective source of truth that we can all see if we have the same information and we could all come to the same conclusion. Postmodernism, I believe, actually does have some value as a critique of modernism. But the way most philosophies get boiled down on the street is usually not as nuanced or helpful. So what we have is we no longer have an outside source of truth that we can all see if we had the same information. Instead, each of us must look within for truth, for right and wrong. And on the surface level, that sounds great, but over a couple of decades of practice, it's starting to break down. Here's the problem. What if I no longer have an objective or an outside source of criteria for determining truth, for determining right and wrong? What happens if when I look into myself, when I look within, how do I discern from what is within me what is good or bad? What is helpful or harmful? What if when I look inside myself, there is a mixture of good and bad? What if something inside me is actually harmful to me or to others? What if I find inside myself anger or racism or jealousy or violence? Our society has told us in this postmodern context that the route to true human flourishing is to be true to yourself, to look within yourself and live out whatever it is that you find there. This, though, assumes everything we find inside ourselves is good and worth living out. It assumes not only a general goodness of people, but actually a total goodness of people. It assumes that everything we find within ourselves is part of our true self that should be lived out. Or, slightly more nuanced, at best, it leaves each of us as an individual up to our own devices to discern what is our true self and what deserves to be lived out. But I know I'm not equipped to do that. What if someone looks within themselves and decides, based on their own criteria, that their true self is prejudiced, and that that is part of their true self that they're going to live out? What if someone sees inside themselves violence, hatred, and manipulation? What is to stop that person from being true to themselves by going and living as a sociopath? That's what they found within themselves. 2,000 years ago, Jesus actually addressed this problem in a slightly different direction. He addressed the very issue. Talking to the religious elite of his day, Jesus challenged them to actually look within themselves. They were academically trained, they were financially stable, they were socially respected people. Part of their culture involved ritual cleaning of themselves and everything that they touched. Literally for them, cleanliness was next to godliness. Cleanliness was an expression of godliness. Jesus addresses this in Mark 7 as well as in Matthew 15. Let me read to you for a moment what Jesus says to this group of people in Mark chapter 7. He, Jesus, went on. What comes out of a man is what makes him unclean. For from within, out of men's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a man unclean. Jesus' point was that, yes, we do need to look inside ourselves, and we need to consider what we see there. But where Jesus differs from our present culture's thinking is that Jesus is a realist. He recognizes that the problems of our world, greed, slander, theft, murder, these do not originate in society, but in the hearts of the individuals who make up society. So the core message then of Christianity is that, at least in part, what we find when we look within ourselves is contaminated. We are not wholly good. We are not pure individuals. And if you look at society, you will see the objective evidence of our lack of pure goodness within ourselves. You read about it in the paper. You see it online on the news. You see it in Twitter flame wars on a regular basis. What is inside ourselves is not wholly good. There is some in there that is not worth living out. So our current secular recipe for true human flourishing is to look within, like what you see, or pick what you like of what you see, and then live that out to the fullest. But what if what is within is contaminated? Even just slightly radioactive, or slightly out of alignment, whatever image you want to use. What if what is inside us reflects abuse in our past, or mental health issues, or false labels that we have accumulated and believed? Or what if inside what is inside us reflects stereotypes we don't even recognize as stereotypes or know how to revise? So this is the big picture philosophically, and it trickles down into our culture. And this is actually why discussions on difficult topics have become so toxic. This is what has brought about the end of civil discourse, that ability to humbly present your position without vilifying, dismissing, or ignoring those who hold a different position. How has this happened? Because if what you believe is true differs from my belief of what's true, sometimes we can just go on our own way and it's not a big deal. But what if your recipe for human flourishing for yourself comes in conflict with my recipe for human flourishing for myself? Who arbitrates between us? To whom can we appeal? There's no objective truth to which we can point to decide, and the result is actually truly Darwinian. It is survival of the strongest. The strongest voice, the person with the most followers, the first person who can claim the moral high ground by calling their opponent a bigot, a Nazi, or a fascist, that person wins, and their recipe for human flourishing gets to be carried out. Because it's what I believe is true for me, what you believe is true for you, and if we have a conflict, we just have to duke it out on social media, in the media, face-to-face, whatever that may be. The philosophical view has led to our dilemma about appropriate treatment for people who experience gender dysphoria. If I look within and what I find disagrees with my physical objective reality, who can arbitrate between those two? Let me give an example. If I look within myself and I consistently, persistently insist that I am grotesquely overweight, but my doctor says I'm a healthy weight, or even maybe underweight. Our society's recipe for true human flourishing says my view wins and I get to live out my reality. The doctor needs to give me liposuction or a stomach band. It's called anorexia. I can object to the body type assigned to me by a doctor at my appointment. He told me that I'm underweight, but I believe myself to be grotesquely overweight. The doctor is then expected to help me bring my physical body into alignment with my true sense of inner self. We recognize that's harmful, but that's how this philosophy plays out. Or another example, perhaps more immediate, maybe a little bit more realistic. What if my sense of inner self says that I am a burden to society and my family? What if my inner self says that my life is not worth living because I have pain or chronic illness? Now it is legal for me to choose assisted suicide. I no longer even have to be terminal, just uncomfortable. Just in the past month, Quebec's highest court struck down the doctor-assisted suicide restriction of reasonable, foreseeable, natural death as a criteria for assisted suicide. So if you now live in Quebec with chronic pain that's not terminal, you can go to a doctor and request assisted suicide, and it is your right for that doctor to help you. It was too restrictive to have natural foreseeable death. This is brand new. This is law. And this has all happened very quickly. So if I also, what if I look inside myself and I believe that I am truly female, but my body says that I am a male, who arbitrates? Which scenario should the medical community go with? In most cases, my internal psychological or emotional perspective is the one that needs to be addressed. But we've lost sight of that. Hopefully you can start to see how ideas have consequences. philosophical ideas can trickle down into our everyday thinking in, frankly, unnuanced ways and lead to unexpected consequences. How then do we respond to the issue of gender dysphoria? Well, first and foremost, with compassion. With compassion. Respond with compassion to individuals who experience gender dysphoria, as well as their friends and their family. In the case of children, the diagnosis of gender dysphoria often comes from their parents' assessment of the child's behavior. We need to respond with compassion to parents who are desperate to protect their children from hardship, from bullying, and from emotional difficulty, which in our current culture right now means the parent is going to say, yeah, my child is, you know, a girl trapped in a boy's body or a boy trapped in a girl's body because they want to protect them from the hardship. The second response that we need to have to gender dysphoria and to, frankly, many other things in our society is to actually ask the person if they are looking within for their true identity. A lot of people will say yes. We need to ask, are you sure that everything you find when you look within is actually good and healthy for your life to flourish? Because I know when I look within myself, there's a lot of junk in there. It scares me. Introspection is good. Not enough people actually look within. The problem, though, is that when we do look within, it's often with rose-colored glasses. We need to take a cold, hard look within and recognize we need something or someone outside ourselves to help us sift through what we find in there and assess which parts are good and which parts are harmful. It shouldn't be left up to us. So begin with compassion. You know, on the societal level, as a society, we also need to respond with compassion. We need to begin with compassion on all levels because there's a lot of fear around this topic because of the toxicity of the discussion. It is not helpful to dismiss gender dysphoria. It is not helpful to dismiss how people feel. We're not arguing over the reality of gender dysphoria. We're arguing over the treatment. On every level, treat people with respect. Acknowledge their pain and their experience of discomfort. Do not dismiss their experience. But we have to get beyond this idea that patients get to self-diagnose and select their own treatment. If I have a lump that isn't a bruise, I don't get to self-diagnose, oh, this is cancer, and then go to my doctor and demand chemotherapy and surgery. If a doctor actually did that, they would lose their license. If they did that and it wasn't cancer, I could sue them for malpractice. It's not actually good for me to self-diagnose and choose my own treatment. If a person is experiencing gender dysphoria, what if the problem isn't their body? Walt Heyer is a man who lived as a transgendered woman for 8 years before transitioning back to being a man. And he regretted his surgery. He now actually has a website. The name of the website is sexchangeregret.com. He has been in contact with literally hundreds of post-operative transgender people who regret their transition and want to go back. And he says that in every single case of people who have contacted him with regret, they had an additional emotional or psychological issue or issues or background trauma of some sort that caused or contributed to their sense of gender dysphoria. Called comorbidity, that's the technical term for multiple sources of trouble, multiple problems. It means they had more than one issue to deal with, and getting a sex change operation didn't help those other issues. They needed other forms of treatment and therapy. This is the problem with our society's current approach. Our culture actually doesn't take the person's whole history into account, which means we are not respecting the whole of a patient's situation. Heyer lists numerous other causes that lead to feelings of gender dysphoria. For instance, a little girl sexually abused may feel weak, may want to be more masculine, to be stronger, or less attractive to future abusers. And so her inner sense of wanting to be strong and less feminine and more masculine doesn't match her outer bodily sex. That's gender dysphoria. A boy who is abused sexually may want to remove the genitalia that were involved in that abuse. He hates having a penis. He doesn't want to have it anymore. He doesn't want to be a boy. And in both cases, this sort of trauma presents itself in terms of gender dysphoria. But gender transition therapy isn't going to help trauma. Regardless of what such victims of abuse believe about their gender identity, transition therapy, hormone treatment, puberty blockers are not the appropriate treatment for trauma. But doctors and psychologists are being handcuffed in their treatment. If they deny transition treatment, they're labeled as bigots and haters. If they are trans-affirming in all other cases, they're still labeled. Blanket prescriptions of transition therapy for all patients is actually not compassion. It does not take the patient seriously, and it does not treat their condition respectfully. With children, many parents are eager to shield them from hardship. We've all heard of helicopter parents who hover over their kids and, let me fix that. Or now snowplow parents who literally bulldoze their way through all difficult. Yeah, I hear the laughter. Oh, yeah. You know, snowplow parents who want to bulldoze all challenges out of the way of their children because they think this is the path to true human flourishing for their child. When a parent sees a child exhibiting behavior that stereotypically fits the other gender, some are becoming quick to determine on behalf of their child, you must be trans, and I'm going to bulldoze the way for you to live out your trans identity. But this can then actually influence the child and reinforce gender stereotypes in them. Just as regularly telling a child that they're fat will cause body image issues, telling them they're dumb causes confidence issues, telling them they're a mistake will cause self-esteem issues, regularly telling a child that they are trans will affect their emotional understanding of themselves. Why can't boys like pink? Why can't a boy think lace is pretty? And like flowy dresses? Why can't girls like to climb trees and wrestle and have short hair? Do boys have to be tough? Do girls have to be maternal? I think most of us would say no, those are stereotypes that aren't helpful. But earlier and earlier, children who don't fit gender stereotypes are being influenced by the label trans. Research from trans-affirming psychologists, every long-term study done on children and youth who exhibit gender dysphoria shows, every single study shows a majority of them outgrow it by the time they're done puberty. Now, the percentages in different studies differ, right? Part of it's sample size, part of it's when you're doing statistical work, sample size is important. Part of it is the difficulty in following up with people. A lot of children and youth who experience gender dysphoria, by the time they're done puberty, they don't want to talk to the clinic anymore. So it's hard to do good research on this, but every single study shows more than 50% of children and youth who experience some form of gender identity question outgrow it by the time they're done puberty. And yet, of all of the children and youth who are put on puberty blockers by the age of 9 or 10, none of them ever come off them. None of them. It's possible that the hormone treatments are actually perpetuating the sense of gender dysphoria. The treatment is perpetuating the symptom. Because statistically speaking, if 50% of kids outgrow gender dysphoria and none of them are coming off the medication during puberty, then even if you say, well, only those who go on the medication, those are the more extreme cases. All right, so let's say 25% of them would have outgrown it if they hadn't been put on the medication. You're still doing harm to 25% of the people who are undergoing treatment. And as the number of people who undergo this treatment expands with the political approach to this, you're going to have more and more people who would have outgrown it who don't have that opportunity. And it's not like you can just say, oh, well, you know, we'll just stop the treatment and they'll go back to normal. No. One of the things that doesn't get discussed is that puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones in adolescents cause permanent sterility. So basically, parents are sterilizing their children in the hopes that they're helping them. And I don't know. I'm not a physician. I'm not a psychiatrist. There may be some people for whom this transition therapy ultimately does help. I don't know. But I do know that from the statistics, there are a lot of people who are getting this treatment, and it's not helpful. And they're regretting it. So let's think about this from another angle, too. When you think of children, when you think of youth, do you immediately think of wisdom and good choices? Do children demonstrate a good ability to assess the risks involved in their actions? I watch kids on the playground at my daughter's school and think, oh my goodness. Are youth good at making their own decisions about without being influenced by their peers or by media or social narratives? No. There's a reason why kids can't vote until they're 18, why they can't drink until they're 19, you know, why they can't drive until they're 16. The gender dysphoria diagnostic criteria is, and I quote from multiple sources, consistent, persistent, and insistent sense that their gender does not match their biological sex. Most teenagers are consistent, persistent, and insistent about ridiculous things. I grew up in the generation of goth. I went to seminary with a couple. They were like, I couldn't believe it. He was like totally clean cut and straight laced. And he showed me pictures of him and his wife when they were in high school. They were totally goth. And I was like, you're kidding me. I'm like, this is awesome. When you have kids and they're teenagers, you can show them they can't rebel because you already did it. But all humor aside, we're talking about a class of people who are easily influenced, who cannot assess risk, and who are not known for making good choices. And yet many therapists and transition clinics ignore this truth and just say, sure, here's a raft of medication that's going to cause permanent changes. Now, to be honest, many psychological handbooks actually do suggest with gender dysphoria a watch and wait approach because they recognize the number of people who outgrow it. The problem is many clinics and therapists don't follow those guidelines. They don't watch and wait to see if the young people will outgrow it. So let me begin my conclusion because I always go long and I'm sorry. Okay, if you're a person wondering about your gender, here, online, wherever, if you experience tension between your biological sex and your sense of gender, let me express to you that I have compassion for you. You are a person in pain, and I grieve for that pain, and I can only imagine the difficulty, confusion, and isolation that may be part of your experience, and for that I am deeply sorry. But I also want you to know that you are deeply loved by God. He made you. And any discomfort that you are feeling and experiencing was not part of his plan for you. You are fearfully and wonderfully made in the image of God, but you are experiencing the consequences of living in a broken world. Let me encourage you, if you struggle with gender dysphoria or gender identity questions, stop looking within yourself for your sense of identity and self-worth. Instead, look to Jesus, who came to earth, experienced physical reality, was cruelly tortured, and then killed because he loves you. He died to reconcile you to God because you are so precious to God. Through him, you can actually find a new identity as the beloved, renewed child of God, the King of Kings, the adopted into God's royal family, son or daughter of God. That is an identity far superior than anything any one of us can find looking within ourselves. Do you know somebody experiencing gender dysphoria? Go out of your way to support that person as a person. Combat the isolation they may feel, but also offer some outside perspective. Encourage them to consider other solutions or treatment for their symptoms. Raise the standard of diagnosis, especially if you are their parent. because the consequences of transgender treatment are serious and permanent, and that is not something you want to get wrong. You wouldn't go along with them if they wanted to amputate a limb because they had a consistent, persistent, and insistent belief that the limb doesn't match the rest of their body, or that it may develop cancer someday, or that it has something wrong with it. Instead, encourage them to watch and wait and see what happens when they finally finish developing. Everybody here, stop looking within yourself for your identity. Yes, look within yourself and see what's there. Self-reflection is very important, but it is not the source of our identity. True human flourishing does not come from living out what you find within. Rather, when you look within, bring with you an objective set of criteria for evaluating what you find. Jesus gives us such a criteria as well as a solution for what to do with the bad stuff you find in there. He gives us a new identity. Jesus literally said that he came so that we could live life to the full. He literally said he came so that we could have human flourishing. And he says our identity is that of a beloved creature of God who is lost. Jesus says that we are loved and valued, but contaminated and alienated from God and one another. Jesus came to repair that breach in our relationships with God and with one another and with ourselves. Whether you experience gender dysphoria or not, at some point in your life, you will experience a deep sense of unease or dissatisfaction with life. This discontent, is the result of all of the contamination that comes out of the human hearts that make up human society. And Jesus came to clean up hearts, to detoxify us from that contamination. And in him, we find our true identity because he designed us in the first place. And amazingly, his resurrection points to a future for us in bodies that don't experience decay, that don't experience dysphoria of any kind or discomfort. And being in a relationship with him is what leads to true human flourishing.